From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is under fire for seemingly dozens of petty scandals. But will his efforts to loosen auto emissions rules endear him enough to Republicans that he can survive? Tariff threats between the U.S. and China are escalating on both sides. We'll talk with a former trade official at the Commerce Department about what kind of trade war might ensue. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, we'll look at President Trump's desire to pull troops out of Syria and send them to the Mexican border. We'll look at teacher strikes that are driving pay increases in Oklahoma, West Virginia, and elsewhere. And Christian Davenport will join us to discuss his book, The Space Barons, about the billionaires who are coming to dominate the private space industry. All that, plus a thumbs up and a thumbs down for Silicon Valley's congressman, and a discussion of middlebrow dining in Washington, D.C., is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. It has been a rough week for EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who is in trouble for everything from getting a sweetheart apartment rental deal from an energy lobbyist to using the money from the Safe Drinking Water Fund to give large raises to top political aides to asking his security detail to turn on their lights and sirens to rush him around Washington in non-emergency situations. In a pattern seen with other soon-to-be-fired Trump officials, the White House has been cruelly noncommittal when asked about Pruitt's standing. "I can't speak to Scott Pruitt's future," was what White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley said on Thursday. But Pruitt also this week announced a key environmental policy initiative, rolling back Obama-era auto emission standards and possibly taking on California's ability to set its own more stringent standards. That's earned him support in his time of trouble from some conservatives, like Senator Ted Cruz. To talk about what Pruitt's been up to, we're joined by Alex Guillen, who covers the Environmental Protection Agency for Politico and Politico Pro. Alex, what is Pruitt's standing? Can he survive this?
It's not really clear at this point. And a large part of that has to do just with the fact that President Trump is known to change his mind on a dime. He tweeted earlier this morning that Pruitt is doing a great job, for example. But on the other hand, it's pretty widely known at this point that a lot of folks at the White House, other than the president, like Chief of Staff John Kelly, are not happy with the stories that have been streaming out about Scott Pruitt. So we're going to have to see. I think at this point, it's sort of a wait-and-see pattern. A lot of that's going to depend on if anything else comes out in the near future.
Rich, what do you make of this? Because this drumbeat of negative stories strongly suggests that there are people in the administration trying to ensure that there is a drumbeat of negative stories on Scott Pruitt. But I wonder, you know, how high that goes. It's clear that John Kelly has a real problem with him. I don't know how to read where the president is on this.
Neither do I. Probably neither does anyone around the president. It does feel a little bit like the Tom Price thing where, you know, you're fantastic until you're not, and then you're thrown out on your ear. I would say, you know, these do not feel like firing offenses to me. The travel, the costly travel, other EPA administrators have had equally costly travel in the past. The arrangement with Condo, you know, got an ethical blessing, but the optics of it are terrible. And I think in that case, just apologize and go rent an apartment at what other, you know, normal people would recognize as a more market rate in Washington, D.C. I'm not sure about the salary. I don't have any problem with someone wanting to pay people they consider very valuable to them. I'm not sure of the particularities of how he went about this. But he's definitely a target by the left. And I mean, he's been extremely effective in terms of implementing the president's deregulatory agenda. And that's a reason why he has a target on his back and a reason why he should be particularly careful rather than the opposite.
Okay, so President Trump seems to be reverting to the permanent campaign these days. But I think the reason Pruitt, someone wrote that he's too crooked to fail, the reason he seems to be hanging on, though he may be out by the end of the day, is that he is not just executing Trump's promises to roll back regulations, but he is a key conduit between Trump and the fossil fuel industry.
My favorite detail from this is about the siren stuff, and that one of the places the New York Times reports that Scott Pruitt wanted to use the lights and sirens to get to faster was Le Diplomat, which is this French, it's a perfectly adequate French bistro in Washington, D.C. that for whatever reason is an object.
Josh's dining snobbery is coming into play here.
I think it's a Fox favorite. I think it's a Fox favorite. Tucker Carlson goes there a lot.
This is a bipartisan affliction in Washington. Overrating of Le Diplomat is a Republican and Democratic phenomenon. But the thing about it, Rich, what I don't get is, I think you're right that from a perspective, if you share Scott Pruitt's perspective on environmental policy, he has been effective in this job, which makes it surprising to me that he has so opened himself up to these sort of critiques. I mean, he gave an interview to Fox News this week that I think he thought was going to be easy, and it wasn't. Yeah. And there's reporting that the White House didn't want him to give the interview. But he got asked by this Fox reporter, basically, isn't moving in with a lobbyist, isn't that the swamp that we're supposed to be draining? And he got all huffy and said the question was unfair. But if he thinks, and the Trump people think, that his work is important, why wouldn't he be careful instead of being reckless like this?
I mean, I totally agree with that. I don't think Scott Pruitt is corrupt in the sense, there's been a connection made between an approval of a portion of a pipeline and the lobbyist that has a connection to this condo. But this administration is approving every pipeline. I mean, that's what they came in set to do. So I don't think he's corrupt in that sense. I just think he's reckless. And look, you're in Washington. You're a big shot. You want to feel like a big shot. So you put the sirens on when you're going to the mediocre French restaurant. And that's something to be guarded against. It's something to be criticized. And if I were Scott Pruitt, the next time I do an interview, I'd do a mea culpa on some of this stuff and hope it passes and Washington's attention is directed elsewhere and I survive.
One thing that there's been focus on is this very expensive trip that he took to Morocco, including a sort of, unscheduled layover in Paris with a number of his aides. And I gather the purpose of his trip to Morocco was to promote U.S. liquid natural gas exports to Morocco. Why would the EPA administrator have been making a trip for that purpose?
That was one of the purposes among, there were a few other things, but that was really the one that stood out. And I'll tell you, I've heard from career folks who work at EPA, they're baffled by that being something that the administrator would focus on, because promoting natural gas exports, they're bending over backward to try and think of a way that would fall under EPA's mission. That would be something that really the energy secretary or the commerce secretary or something would normally be doing. He's never tried to hide the fact that he supports the oil and gas industry. I mean, back in 2014, when he was the Oklahoma Attorney General, for example, the New York Times wrote a story about how he and other Republican attorneys general across the country had sort of banded together and were teaming up with fossil fuel companies to fight Obama-era EPA regulations. They had a really good example of this was they had a letter to EPA about a regulatory issue. It was written by Devon Energy, which is a major oil and gas producer out in Oklahoma. Pruitt changed a couple of words and then sent it to EPA with his signature at the bottom.
Katrina, would you agree with my assessment that Democrats have mostly failed to gain any political advantage out of the idea that the Republicans and Pruitt in particular are too close to the fossil fuel industry? I feel like there's been a shift on environmental issues over the last 20 years or so. As more of the focus has gotten on climate change, to a lot of people, those concerns look distant, both in terms of time and geography.
No.
And so there's not the sense that, I am individually harmed if the government is in bed with the fossil fuel industry. In fact, it might create jobs.
No, I think that there is a strong feeling, not just on the left, but in this country, about clean air, clean water, clean food. That transcends the partisan divide. And I think there's increasing refocus, even while climate sits at the center, on environmental injustice, on the placing of where do these, the rollback of regulations that have made this a safer, cleaner place, I think is really at the center of a politics. And I think majorities support this and don't buy this false narrative that it's a trade-off between jobs and clean air, clean water. So, but I step back. And Josh, I take issue with, these are minor scandals. I think what we're witnessing is the accumulation of these scandals in an administration. The fish rots from the head, and President Trump has, expanded big business profits, his own personal private business at the expense of the public interest. So I think that sense of public interest, again, is not a partisan issue.
What do you make of that, Rich? Is this a good issue for Democrats?
I don't think so. I don't think climate is a great issue for Democrats. I think even if it polls well, that the number of people who really care about it in terms of their daily lives is very low. And my view is we have blessed with a lot of oil and gas in this country. We're basically standing on top of great reserves of wealth. Go get it, dig it out, and sell it. And we have the air and water in this country is cleaner than ever before, which is one reason why the regulatory focus is more and more on trying to bend the curve on the global temperature 100 years from now. And I just think anything we do in this country alone to try to do that is misbegotten and just a drop in the bucket. Plus, it's just I'm not confident that we really know what the temperature is going to be 100 years from now and that it's going to be a threat. So I wholeheartedly endorse the administration's policy on this front, and it's an area where they've been quite successful.
Well, let's talk about this related EPA announcement this week on auto emissions. And Alex, I'm hoping you can help us understand what the practical effect of this is, because the EPA, they're going to revisit these more strict auto emission standards that the Obama administration had imposed. And then they might do something with regard to this waiver that California has, allowing it to impose its own standards. Do you have a sense of where that California thing is going to land? Is the EPA really going to try to unwind that? Will they have success if they do so? And then how does that affect what the auto market will be? Because there's this question that if you roll back just the federal standard and allow California to leave its own in place, that automakers might not make two sets of cars, and that therefore this federal change might not even have that big an effect on emissions, because basically California would govern the whole country in terms of what auto emissions would look like.
Right. Well, this is a very complicated issue, but I'll try to simplify it and make it understandable. You're right. If the California waiver issue, the Clean Air Act, gives California special powers to set their own regulations if EPA gives them a waiver, which is related to the state's historic pollution problems. And other states can agree to follow California if they want to. A dozen states currently do, including New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Washington State, Oregon. So about they represent 40% of Americans and about a third of the auto market. So a huge chunk, which makes extricating the two sort of difficult. What's going to happen now is EPA, California automakers will come to the table and negotiate on potential changes for the model years 2022 to 2025, which is what we're talking about. So cars that are still being designed, are going to be designed pretty soon. A large part of this idea is that EPA may be able to use the threat of trying to revoke this waiver to California that was granted under Obama as a way to get California to agree to certain changes to the program. What will happen if they fall apart on that issue and EPA does try to revoke the waiver? A lot of people are pretty certain California would win on that point just because the Clean Air Act doesn't actually say EPA can do that. It doesn't say EPA can revoke a waiver that's been granted. And that's sort of, I think, goes to providing certainty to the states about regulations, which is something Scott Pruitt talks about a lot. And then just to talk about the market impacts you were mentioning, it's not so much what would happen there is that there would be two types of cars, and you've got car A and car B that has a different pollution control system. What you would start seeing more likely is if you cross the border from one type of state to another, you would see car dealers selling you'd have different availabilities for cars or different prices for cars. And basically, in a California-type state, more polluting cars, larger SUVs and that sort of thing would cost more than they would if you crossed the border into Nevada. And you get that sort of thing all over the place.
How would that work? Couldn't you just buy your car in Nevada and then register it in California? Is it really possible to separate those markets?
That's certainly a big worry. I mean, that's something that people are pointing out is, you're talking about potentially hundreds or thousands of dollars would be the difference. And of course, that's the upfront cost. Supporters of these fuel efficiency rules are saying, when you look at the lifetime of these vehicles, ultimately you're spending less on gas, even when it's at a low price like today.
Mm-hmm. Rich, what do you make of the federal government basically trying to end federalism in this area? I realize, there are things about, it's a national market. There's efficiency for having one standard for the whole country.
For reasons we just stated, one national standard would be preferable, and I think that's what the law, the Clean Air Act, originally wanted. I think these auto emission standards that were rushed through at the end of the Obama administration are completely absurd, and the problem is most people, especially with gas prices low, want to buy a truck or a SUV. Those are about two-thirds of the auto sales now in the United States. So the car companies resort to this ridiculous game where they build electric cars or cars that meet these standards and sell them at a loss and oftentimes get subsidized for producing them. And that just seems completely uneconomical and absurd to me.
I love how conservatives sort of pick and choose, cherry pick the federalism they prefer.
Alex Guillen of Politico, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine to talk about trade wars being good and easy to win. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On Thursday, the Trump White House announced its intention to impose a further $100 billion a year in tariffs on Chinese goods. This was a response to China's response to Trump's initial announcement of tariffs on China, which were a response to Chinese infringement of American intellectual property. The stock market has been gyrating all week, falling sharply on days when a trade war was looking more likely, and on other days getting reassured by statements from Trump officials like Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and National Economic Council head Larry Kudlow. On CNBC on Wednesday, Kudlow emphasized that this is a negotiating process and the tariffs may never even take effect. You know, there are carrots and sticks in life, but ultimately he is a free trader, is what Kudlow said about the president. To help us understand these mixed messages, we're joined by Amy Sellico. She's a principal of Albright Stonebridge Group, where she leads the firm's China practice. Amy worked on China policy at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative and at the Commerce Department. Welcome, Amy.
Great to be with you.
Amy, here's what I'm confused about. I realize Trump is trying to send tough messages to China while also not rattling the stock market too much, but China can hear what the president's advisors say on CNBC. So how does this actually play out as a negotiating process? What does China do when they see these mixed messages coming from the administration?
China is doing, as a matter of fact. So what's happened, it's a national holiday in China on Friday, what's already happened in China. But what they did was they called together a press conference at the Ministry of Commerce in order to very strongly push back against what the president announced yesterday and saying that China's not going to rule out any option to counterattack what the U.S. is doing, and they have a detailed action plan in place. So if the president's strategy was to try to intimidate China by, you know, proposing $100 billion in additional tariffs or goods to be tariffed, it's not working. The Chinese are saying we are not going to back down. And so in Beijing, they're also saying, while the U.S. government says that we continue to talk government to government on these issues, there have been no ongoing trade discussions. And so the Chinese do continue to say, we do need to talk this out. But if the United States takes action, we're going to retaliate.
So how does that play out if it continues to escalate? Because obviously a thing that people are worried about here is domestic effects on things like the agricultural industry, but there are also domestic effects in China, right? If China imposes big tariffs on American agricultural imports to China, then presumably food becomes more expensive for people in China. Does China have any more domestic political stomach for a trade war than we do?
They certainly don't want it, and they've been upfront in saying that. I mean, if you look at different product categories, you're absolutely right. The Chinese have to import these products into China, but they could look to Brazil, they could look to the EU, to Canada, to other markets to try to take the pressure off of the domestic market. But no, I don't think in any way the Chinese government is thinking this is good for China. It's absolutely not.
Rich, a thing I hear from a lot of people, and I think you said it in a column this week, was that basically China is a bad actor on trade and we need to find ways to hold them accountable, but this is the wrong way. What, in your view, would be the right way?
Well, two things. One, a little bit like North Korea, where there's been a lot of saber rattling, but I've always thought it's going to much more likely to end up in some sort of diplomatic settlement rather than war. I think the outcome here is much more likely to be some sort of deal that's not highly meaningful that the president can wave around as a victory and say he's made progress that Bush and Obama didn't, rather than a full-born trade war. But I think, you know, the administration seems to be throwing around these big headline numbers that worry people and worry the stock market, at least on certain days, where you'd want to be more strategic and targeted. So one approach might be that any Chinese company that we can reliably prove has stolen U.S. technology would just be locked out of the U.S. market. Or you could forge a broad coalition of our allies to pressure China on certain practices, including the theft of intellectual property. But just this tit-for-tat on tariffs, I think, is not likely to move the Chinese. They are very committed to this mercantilist policy. Even if they make promises to change it, it's very unlikely they would follow through on them. So this would have to be, you know, a effort the rest of the Trump administration, however long that lasts, and would have to have a lot of a thought behind it and our allies on board. And I just don't think that effort's been there.
You know, Josh, I think Trump's decision to take on China is long overdue. Too many of these trade deals have been written for the benefit of big multinationals, not for workers. But, you know, not surprisingly, Trump and his team have provided more theater than substance. And I think a progressive strategy, an alternative, renegotiation of current treaties with enforceable protections for environmental and labor standards and these private tribunal system for investors, go beyond simply renegotiating trade deals. I mean, it's more, it's less about tariffs, as Rich said, than about protecting powerful interests. And I think a different trade policy would challenge those interests. Big pharma, feature a global effort to close tax havens, crack down on avoidance, and break with this neoliberal market fundamentalism, which is at the core of the current trade system policies. And I would add simply two other things, that it's important that progressives fight for social insurance. And I think also that where's the public investment and the infrastructure plan? All of that's been shelved. Investments in science and technology, yes, but they've been slashed. So I think there is a different policy that needs to be on offer, that progressives need to put on offer, not to say, oh my God, this is terrible what Trump is doing, but in these scrambled political times, to seize what he's doing, say it's theater, not substance, and offer an alternative.
Amy, what do you see as an off-ramp here? What is a way for us to get out of this without a devastating trade war?
Yeah, it's. I think that I agree with elements of what both Rich and Katrina are saying. And I think both of you are saying we've got a problem, but what the policy that's been put forward isn't going to address the problem that exists. Very much, you know, to what Rich has said, the intellectual property abuses, the industrial policy that China's put in place does unfairly protect the China market and doesn't allow for competition that would help American farmers and American manufacturers to export into China as well as to invest into China. And so this set of tariffs is going to hurt consumers as well as producers. It's just not good for the U.S. economy. It's not good for the Chinese economy either. And so, to your point, Josh, what can happen? Unfortunately, China doesn't have the appetite to negotiate a new set of. We don't have a free trade agreement with China. And so, Katrina's very good example of how we could actually protect American workers better. That is a bridge too far right now with China, because there's no even discussion of forming a free trade agreement with China where we could talk about raising standards, environmental standards, labor standards. That is going to have to wait. In the meantime, we do have to avoid a trade war by having our two governments come together and say, what do we need from one another? And the United States government has to, more clearly than it's done to date, state that we need to see American industry not being harmed by Chinese industrial policies and intellectual property theft. But tariffs really don't put that kind of structure in place. They simply will punish China, but also punish the United States workers and consumers. And so getting the U.S. and China back to serious discussions on this issue may be what President Trump is trying to do by threatening China. We don't have the leverage to get China to stop subsidizing its industries. That's what President Trump is trying to get to. Tariffs just aren't an effective tool to do so.
Well, to Rich's point, that does sound kind of similar to the North Korea situation, that the hope is that behind the bluster, there is a strategy to bring everyone to the table. We will see if it plays out that way. Amy, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still with me are Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine and Rich Lowry of National Review. Let's talk about Syria. There's this somewhat alarming, in my view, story from the Associated Press this week about the president ordering a precipitous withdrawal of American troops from Syria over the objections of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other top defense advisors. The president's position is we've spent too much time and money fighting wars in the Middle East, but the concern is that if we withdraw quickly from Syria, it'll create a vacuum that allows for the reconstitution of ISIS, sort of recreating the situation that got us in there in the first place. As with so many things in this White House, details are fuzzy on what a withdrawal policy would actually look like. Katrina, this seems like an example where the president is speaking at 30,000 foot terms, your language in terms of, you know, no endless war, too much footprint in the Middle East. But this seems like a fairly haphazard way of following that principle.
You know, he's reverting to candidate Trump. That's what he was saying on the campaign trail, the mindless wars. He said he was against Iraq war. But, you know, it's a scrambled political time, Josh, because I'm trying to keep two thoughts in my head at the same time. One is I find Donald Trump's policies and tweets and stance odious. On the other hand, he sometimes says things that make sense. And there's a group called Just Foreign Policy, very good group, which put out a statement: we commend Donald Trump's stated intention to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria once their mission to combat ISIS has been completed.
Well, that's a key clause there.
But that doesn't mean vacuum. I think creative, tough diplomacy. There is no military, I've said this before, no military solution to Syria's ongoing civil regional war. Congress has never explicitly authorized this U.S. military role in Syria. We don't walk away, but we de-escalate and demilitarize and address the humanitarian crisis, which is destabilizing the region and Europe. And I think that if we continue to be militarized presence, it is not going to resolve Syria.
Rich, this seems like yet another country where we're in the situation where we don't want to have troops there forever, but it's hard to see what the end game is where it becomes possible to pull out and leave a stable situation behind that doesn't create a major security risk for the U.S. When do we get
Correct.
To that point in Syria?
Well, first of all, this is just not the way for a president to make or announce policy with no one being aware of it, including the people who are on the ground in a very sensitive situation. During the campaign, you know, Trump often said, I'm not going to reveal my plan for defeating ISIS because you don't tell the enemy what you're going to do. And this is a textbook example of doing exactly that. And it's clearly his instinct, what he wants to do, but it's still considered. And look, no one likes quote-unquote endless wars, but we're not in the situation now where we were in Iraq, you know, during the Bush surge there, or in Afghanistan during the Obama surge there. You know, we are asking our men and women to put life and limb at risk, and we are losing people occasionally, and every casualty is a tragedy. But this is a manageable level, I think, of military involvement that you could actually sustain for a long time if you had to. Just that the problem is Syria and Afghanistan, to some extent Iraq, although it's in a better situation than either of those, they're just not going to be fixed anytime soon. And it's going to be unlikely anytime soon that it's going to be in our interest to completely wash our hands of it.
You know, there's this idea that they're responsible men. They're mostly men in the room who are restraining Donald Trump. I mean, this is what President Obama called the blob. I mean, it's this discredited bipartisan foreign policy establishment, which has taken us into these endless wars. So while Trump has no coherent policy-making abilities, he does sort of spurt out truth. I think it's worth remembering, again, he's reverting to the campaign. If you recall in 2016, there were, I think, 90 counties which voted for Trump. They had the highest levels of killed and wounded in the multiple deployments in these endless wars. And I think that is a very strong feeling in this country. The country's not anti-war, but it is against endless war without victory. And that is a moment to begin to think of alternatives and not just continue down a path which is not leading to more security. It's leading to trillions of dollars, lives lost money looted.
So speaking of return to candidate Trump and America First and the sort of inward turning approach to foreign policy, Trump has been talking about sending troops somewhere within the U.S. this week, saying that he was going to send the military to the Mexican border to help with border enforcement. It eventually became clear he was talking about using the National Guard for that purpose, which actually has a lot of precedent. Both the Bush administration and the mm-hmm. Obama administration at times used National Guard troops in a support role to assist the Border Patrol. Trump has also been floating the idea that the military will start building a wall along the Mexican border. Rich, this seems like, first of all, I mean, the president's been talking about the need for a big, strong military, and at the same time, he's talking about diverting its resources to a purpose that is fundamentally not a national defense purpose. But it also seems to reflect the president's obsession with the border and the way that he confuses it with the overall immigration policy. I think you'd agree with me that the border is not the locus of our primary enforcement problems on immigration right now, at least not the sort of problems that can be fixed with these sorts of, you know, shows of force there, as opposed to some of these questions about asylum and whatnot.
Yeah, I'd underline the word show, and that's what it is. These National Guard troops will be able to help a little bit at the margins, but the fundamental issue, one, I think there are a lot of policy areas from a restrictionist enforcement perspective that would be more important than just the border. E-Verify, keeping employers from hiring illegal labor would be the most important.
I mean, this decision isn't about border security. I come back again to the permanent campaign. Trump is stoking fears and trying to create a crisis where there isn't one ahead of the 2018 midterms. Part of it is he seems increasingly desperate as he watches Fox News and Ann Coulter berate him to find ways to compensate for his failure to deliver on his promise to build that big, beautiful border wall on Mexico's dime. And I mean, you know, Rich, I mean, there may be a slight surge at the moment, but unauthorized border crossings are at their lowest level in 46 years. And so
they're
the urgent
up,
need
though.
For military... Well, let's take the... You know, 46 years is a record, is a track record. Let's look at that. It was 1.6 million in 2000. It was 310,000 last year. And I think some of that's Mexican economies improved. And there's been over, I mean, Trump doesn't like to talk about the Obama administration in any favorable way. I don't favor what Obama did, but there was real investment in technology infrastructure and, you know, border patrol agents. So I think it's about the politics of it. I was struck in the West Virginia speech. Remember, he was supposed to talk about the tax cuts, which the party wants him to really amp up. He couldn't stay on script.
He literally threw his script away.
He
said it was boring, and then he talked about this stuff. Now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
Well, since we're going total Beltway Acela corridor in the show with ratings of Washington, D.C. restaurants, I'll continue with that theme and highlight a tweet by my friend Jamie Kirchick, a writer for the Brookings Institute. And he writes, for whatever it's worth, I think people who talk on the quiet car of the Acela should be beheaded, which really goes to the ambiguous quality of the quiet car. It's great. One, that it's quiet, but the downside, too, is that you're surrounded by a bunch of mini totalitarians.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your tweet of the week?
So my tweet is by Connie Schultz, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ohio columnist. She tees off of the New York Times story on The Atlantic cuts ties with conservative writer Kevin Williamson. In the lead, the writer talks about how liberals are angered, and she writes, regarding this lead, surely not just liberals are, quote, angered when a man calls for women who have had abortions to be hanged. Why is advocacy for human decency characterized as a partisan act?
My tweet of the week comes from Mark Seagraves, who's a reporter for Washington's local NBC affiliate. He says the D.C. government issues citation to owner of apartment Scott Pruitt rented because they did not have proper license to rent the unit. Possible fine of $2,034. This Pruitt scandal is mushrooming out in directions nobody could have imagined. I've been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Rich Lowry of National Review. We'll be back to talk about space. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. We will get to billionaires with rockets in a second, but I want to talk first about these teacher strikes. Oklahoma lawmakers are considering passing their second tax increase in a week in an effort to end a teacher strike. Oklahoma has some of the lowest paid public school teachers in the country, and many school districts there have moved to 4 days a week schedules to save money. So last week, the state legislature passed a package of tax increases on the oil and gas industry and other sectors of the economy that they say will allow an average teacher salary increase of $6,000 a year. But teachers are holding out for more, a move that led Republican Governor Mary Fallon to compare them to, quote, a teenage kid that wants a better car. The strike in Oklahoma comes on the heels of a successful teacher strike in West Virginia that got raises of thousands of dollars for teachers. Rich, what strikes me here is that we've had a number of years, basically ever since the financial crisis, where you had state government fights dominated by national questions about taxes and debt sustainability and that sort of thing. And now the economy's improved, and it seems like voters, they have an expectation that the government will use the new resources we have available to provide high-quality services. And in some of these states, they don't see the government's meeting that demand. And that's why you see even Republican-controlled legislatures in some states raising taxes, responding to voters who now do want higher taxes for higher spending, at least on certain things.
Yeah, and it also may be just amplifying your point, but slightly different angle. It just may be a product of a tighter labor market where all workers across the board begin to expect more pay. And I'm generally skeptical of across-the-board pay increases for teachers. I think merit pay has much to say for it, but in Oklahoma, these teaching colleges would graduate teachers, and they'd all go work in Texas. So that is a problem that you want to address.
I think this is an extraordinary moment. I mean, I think it's a turning point. It's not a flash in the pan. It's about more than the demand for higher wages and benefits. It's a revolt against decades of policies that gutted public institutions. And it's a response, I think you suggested this, Josh, to the decimation of state spending on education since the 2008 recession. I was interested. Corey Robin, who's a political scientist, argues that what we're seeing is an attack on the Prop 13 order. Your listeners in California, 1978, right? California passed property tax slashing Proposition 13, which portended the Reagan revolution and the general shift to the right. And I think we're seeing today's rebellion, Prop 13, in reverse. And there's a genuine anger and disaffection over the impact of deep budget cutbacks in conservative red states. Teachers are bringing this home by refusing to just confine their energy to pay. It's about solidarity. It's about dignity. And they're highlighting the conditions of deterioration, the textbooks aging, crumbling infrastructure buildings. So I think this could be a very important moment. It's ironic because it comes at a moment when the assault on labor is ferocious. This Janus decision, the Supreme Court's likely to bring down one that will really hurt public sector unions. But you have this running parallel. So it's a very, I think, important political, economic and social moment.
Rich, to Katrina's point, did some of these Republican-controlled states go too far on these tax control measures? I mean, for example, in Oklahoma, part of the reason they got in the situation where you had these four-day school weeks and you had all those teachers fleeing to Texas where they could get a reasonable salary is that they have a provision in the state constitution. You need a three-quarters majority in order to pass a tax increase. So, I mean, we've seen this week that it is sometimes possible to obtain that three-quarters majority, but you really have to get in a situation the public views is fairly dire before you can have a public policy decision to have the government raise taxes.
I have a colleague who's in Oklahoma and wrote a piece about the teacher situation down there for a website this week. And he just argues the root of the problem is what you're getting at. The Constitution is outdated and sort of a disaster. And that if you wanted a state that's better governed than Oklahoma has been, even under Republican control, that you need to address the Constitution and its structure and how it works.
Yeah, I mean, about 20% of Oklahoma's school districts have gone to four-day weeks. I mean, the police, the state police, have rationed gasoline. I mean, is this America? Is this, you know, the richest nation in the world? It's a moment to reflect. But I do think these strikes have the potential also to transform a funding, an education debate, so it moves away from teacher bashing and what has been used by the right as a cover for undermining the very idea of public education. I think there are a lot of things that come out of this.
I want to talk about one more topic this week. I want to turn and talk about space. In a cabinet meeting last month, President Trump talked up the major investments that a few billionaires have been making in space-oriented companies, some of which are working closely with NASA on the space program. Here's what the president had to say about that.
Rich guys, they love rocket ships. And that's good. It's better than us paying for them.
Don't tell Trump, but this view marks a continuation of policies started in the Obama administration. Obama shut down a Bush-era NASA program for manned spaceflight and started working with Boeing and Elon Musk's SpaceX to serve the International Space Station. To talk about the rise of public-private partnerships in space, we're joined by Christian Davenport, who covers the aerospace industry for The Washington Post. Christian has a new book out called The Space Barons: Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks for having me.
So can you describe for us how the relationships with these companies are changing the way our space program works?
Yeah, and it actually goes back even before Obama to the Bush administration when they were looking at phasing out the space shuttle, which eventually went away in 2011. NASA and the United States government found itself without the ability to fly astronauts from U.S. soil. And today we now rely on the Russians to be able to do that, which is a little bit ironic given that in the Cold War era, we defeated the Soviet Union in the race to the moon. So the NASA and the White House under the Bush administration started relying on the private sector. And one of those key companies was SpaceX, which is headed by Elon Musk. And initially, the idea is that they would fly cargo, supplies, food, equipment, that sort of thing to the International Space Station and not astronauts. Under Obama, they sort of doubled down on that program to have SpaceX and Boeing fly astronauts to the International Space Station. And those flights, the first test flights could be this year, though probably more likely early next year. And now with the Trump administration coming in, and as you just heard him say, he likes these billionaires with their rockets, there's a lot of talk about partnering with the private industry to go deeper into space and to the moon. And under the Trump administration, you've seen the reconstitution of the National Space Council that's headed by Vice President Pence. You know, space is not really a big priority for many administrations. And if they are going to have any success, I think they realize that they need to tap these private industries that are funded by these billionaires who have lots of resources and are really passionate about space.
I just think this is all this activity is really cool, and I'm old enough to remember when kids had glossy photos of astronauts and rockets on their walls, bedroom walls, and I think we lost that excitement when the Apollo program went away. I consider the space shuttle and the International Space Station basically white elephant programs, and now we're talking about, you know, human adventure again, potentially going to Mars. And Christian, I have two questions for you on that front. Elon Musk says we need to get to Mars because something drastically wrong might happen on Earth. Is that a plausible reason to go to Mars? Wouldn't any Mars colony be heavily dependent on the Earth for a very long time? And two, whenever this topic comes up, I love to ask friends and colleagues a very simple question, which I'm going to ask you. And Christian, do not try to wiggle out of this. In 2035, will there be humans living on Mars? Yes or no?
I'll start with that. Living on Mars, I mean, my guess is no. It's too hard. It's too difficult. Mars is one of those problems that everyone talks about, and it's always sort of 20 years away, and it's been 20 years away since like 1969. But that sort of goes back to what you were talking about and with Elon Musk and, you know, this idea that, you know, going to Mars is sort of a plan B, you know, in case there was anything that happened to Earth. You know, if there was some sort of a extinction event, if there was an asteroid that hit the Earth and humanity, you know, went the way of the dinosaur and became extinct, we would need to sort of back up the human race on another planet. I mean, look, frankly, I think that's an aspirational goal. I think, you know, we're talking about these billionaires and they have big visions and big plans and they, you know, laid down these real high water marks. But really, you know, before we get to Mars, what they want to achieve in the short term and where they're making real progress is just creating a more reliable, affordable, efficient way to get to space. I mean, for the moment, you know, forget Mars. We need to be able to get to low Earth orbit, to the International Space Station, much more frequently, much more reliably. And we're beginning to see that, having a private company be able to launch cargo to the International Space Station is a big deal. It's something nobody thought really was going to be possible at the prices that are being offered. Being able to reuse the boosters. I mean, I think by now a lot of people have seen, thanks because they have revitalized interest in space and they've kind of made it cool again. And part of that is, you know, launching these rockets that then fly back to Earth instead of being ditched in the ocean, which was, you know, typically what was done. And Elon and Jeff Bezos would tell you that that's, you know, crazy if you want to get to space affordably. It's like flying from New York to LA and then throwing away the airplane. So it's those incremental steps, you know, that I think they need to achieve first, and that's what they're focused on. And they set Mars because it's good to have a destination. It's good to have a big goal to get to, you know, and when John F. Kennedy sent us on that mission to go to the moon in 1961, it's sort of, you need to put something up on the chalkboard that said, this is the ultimate goal. But in the meantime, what they're really focused on is building those steps to be able to get there much more reliably, first to low Earth orbit, then to the moon. Then you can begin talking about, you know, getting to Mars.
So, Christian, quick question. I mean, John F. Kennedy spoke of space as a great new frontier. It was the commons. It was the public space. I'm not reflexively opposed to private-public partnerships, but you've got these billionaires, rich guys with their rocket ships and investments. Are we going to see like Amazon franchises, or, you know, Mark Cuban staking out parts of space that will be his only? Is there a kind of new space colonialism here that we should be concerned about?
I think what the parallel that they would draw is that this is like the early days of the internet. And, you know, but to some extent that was already the foundation of the internet was in place when, say, Jeff Bezos came along or Elon Musk came along and were working with Amazon and PayPal. And as Jeff would say, when he founded Amazon, there were the cable lines that were already had been put in place by the phone companies. The Postal Service could deliver his books and his packages. He could take payment from the credit card. That infrastructure was there. That infrastructure is not yet really in place for space. It's still too hard. It's still too expensive. What they want to do is build that infrastructure that then you could set up a whole new sort of dynamic economy that could take place in space. And you're already starting to see some of this. I mean, we talk a lot about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson, the guys with their big rockets, as Donald Trump said. But there's already, you know, in their wake, an economy and an industry that's starting to grow from, you know, a company named Bigelow Aerospace that's building habitats that could be built in space. You've seen companies like Planet out of Silicon Valley in San Francisco that is putting up already small satellites. I mean, we think of satellites as big, exquisite, you know, $200 million behemoths out there. Now, these are much smaller, about the size of a shoebox that can do all sorts of things from beaming down internet to all parts of the world. Remote sensing, monitoring the health of the planet, you know, looking at agriculture, erosion, counting whales, all sorts of things. You know, is it initially dominated by the billionaires? Absolutely. I think ultimately their goal is to sort of build that infrastructure like, you know, the railroad going west. Then you can see others flourish. But if the barrier to entry remains high, if it's too hard to get to space and too hard to set up companies in space, then I think there is a concern that will only be dominated by, you know, people with, you know, extensive means.
You mentioned Jeff Bezos there a few times, and obviously Jeff Bezos has been in the news the last couple of weeks related to that issue about the post office delivering Amazon packages. How does the president's feud with Jeff Bezos potentially affect this? Obviously, you have a president who's talking up the work with these billionaires. You also have a president who has strong opinions about which billionaires are good and which billionaires are bad. Is there a risk that sort of that favoritism is going to end up driving what the space program looks like?
Well, if I was Jeff Bezos' space company, which is called Blue Origin, it's certainly something that I would be thinking about. This is a company that I think ultimately wants to partner with NASA. They pitched NASA last year on a plan to build a lander that could land on the moon, a program called Blue Moon. They have said that they want to bid on contracts from the Pentagon to fly national security payloads and satellites and compete against SpaceX and the United Launch Alliance, which now compete for those contracts. So, yeah, I mean, it is looking to NASA and to the Pentagon, you know, for business. And then, frankly, there are regulatory concerns as well. So I haven't seen any evidence that that's been a factor yet, but it's certainly something that would be on my radar.
Christian Davenport, I want to thank you for joining us and congratulations on the new book again, which is called The Space Barons.
Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Speaking of Jeff Bezos, over the last week, we've witnessed the spectacle of a president of the United States deliberately talking down the stock of American company, Amazon. This is appalling, and to the extent it's dependent on the economic case against Amazon, it's mistaken. A study by the Progressive Policy Institute finds that jobs at Amazon fulfillment centers are actually good jobs and pay more than traditional retail. Just another reason to leave Amazon alone.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's on your mind?
Late last month, Congress authorized a massive aid package to Ukraine. The package contained a provision whose inclusion was supported by Congressman Ro Khanna of California. The provision bars U.S. aid from going to the 3,000-strong Azov Battalion, a unit of the Ukrainian National Guard with a heavy neo-Nazi contingent and a long record of horrific human rights abuses. In response, The Hill published a piece denying the neo-Nazi elements and accusing Khanna of being a Russian stooge. Hill commentator provided no evidence to support his smear, but he didn't need one. He simply accused Khanna of being in league with Putin.
Well, this is a surprising coincidence. My rant is also about Ro Khanna. California Representative Ro Khanna tweeted this week that we need more affordable housing near transit, but that he does not support Senate Bill 827, a proposal we discussed on this show a few months ago that would force California cities and towns to allow dense housing near transit. Khanna says he supports development that is thoughtful, but many in the community have concerns about 827 and that it shouldn't treat cities and small towns alike. Khanna represents small towns in Silicon Valley like Sunnyvale, population 140,000, and Cupertino, the home of Apple, with 58,000 residents. Towns like this are the key problem on housing in California. Prices there have gone sky high because local officials oppose home building near where all the Silicon Valley jobs are. And the pervasiveness of Khanna's attitude, that dense housing is okay for San Francisco and Oakland but shouldn't be forced near where I live, is why California's housing market has gotten so dysfunctional and expensive. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Amy Sellico, Christian Davenport, and Alex Guillen. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.